Thank you for tuning in to another episode of an Open Water Swimmers podcast. You may or may not know that I am endeavouring on my own set of ultramarathon swims this year and next. Clearly, compared to some of my incredible guests over these seasons, these events are relatively piddly. But nonetheless, I'm booked to swim the 65 kilometres around Jersey in September of 2023, and then I have my own English Channel solo attempt in August of 2024. I'm raising money for a charity called Amaze, who help families who have children with disabilities. They're based in Sussex. So if you're enjoying this podcast, please do head to my Just Giving page, which you can find on the blurb of the pod, or also if you go to my Instagram handle, OWSwimPod, it's there for you to find. Please donate anything at all. All donations are welcome, no matter how big or small. You can think of it, if you like, as just buying me a coffee. If you want to hear more about my story and why I am raising money for Amaze, then check out Intrepid Water and fellow swim podcaster Shannon Keegan and her interview with me back in May of 2022. Thank you. Enjoy the show.
I'm Mark Andrews, and you're listening to an Open Water Swimmers podcast.
Welcome to episode 10 of an Open Water Swimmers podcast. I'm Will Ellis, and thank you to everyone who has sponsored me so far on my upcoming swims, raising money for Amaze, who help families with neurodiverse children. Thank you so much. It's wonderful motivation, and I am extremely grateful for your support. It goes without saying to leave me a rating wherever you get your podcasts from. And of course, do follow the Instagram and Twitter handles at OWSwimPod for all the latest news. I've been wanting to record today's guest for quite some time. About 18 months ago, I developed a shoulder issue outside of the pool, which prevented me from swimming. Having never had any issues with my shoulders before, and also at that time booking a channel swim a few years later, I needed to fix it properly. I found a place many a Sussex-based swimmer has found solace before, and he's a bit of a local legend in getting broken swimmers back into the water. He is himself a swimmer and a surfer, and an osteopath and physiotherapist, etc. It was terrific to welcome to the podcast Mark Andrews. So it's my pleasure, and I'm thrilled to welcome my friend Mark Andrews onto the podcast, who was instrumental in getting me going again back in the water. Thank you for taking the time to come and chat to me on the podcast.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Will. It's a real pleasure to be here, a real honour. And I am suffering from a little bit of imposter syndrome, of course, having listened to all your podcasts and your amazing roster of guests. So I feel a little bit anxious about being here, but I'll do my best.
Oh, don't be silly. The whole point of the podcast is that it's a broad spectrum of people who enjoy the water. So I am honoured that you want to come and share your knowledge and talk about the water with everyone. So let's jump straight in. So Mark, why do you swim? Obviously, not everyone starts in the open water. So it might be, why did you take up swimming? Why do you continue to swim and surf, which I know you do? And what is it about the water, especially within your line of work, that keeps you coming back to enjoy the sea and the pool?
Yeah, so I've thought about this question. And actually, I think I did learn to swim in the open water. So my earliest memories of swimming were on holiday with my parents. So we used to go to Menorca. I know that you're a Balearic swimmer as well. And so we were in the 60s and 70s, so it gives my age away a bit, but we would be down in Menorca. And so I learned to swim, if my memory is correct, I learned to swim in the open water down there, which of course is warm and clear and no tides and very safe. So I always loved being in the water, and my mum and dad always told me that I was just, as soon as there's only water, I was in.
Yeah.
And so I became a reasonable swimmer, and the trouble was I ended up being one of those kids who had lots of ear infections. And in those days, in the 60s and 70s, it was all put down to dirty public pools. So I had to end up having surgery in my ears more than once. And I remember actually to the day that the consultant sitting after surgery and the consultant saying, well, he's not allowed to swim. He's not allowed to swim in public pools anymore. He just shouldn't do it. And I remember being completely devastated that that was the end of swimming for me. And I loved it, and it was heartbreaking. So luckily, my mum and dad, we lived in a out in the countryside with a decent bit of land. And so my dad built a pool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not for me. I mean, although I'd be very flattered if it was, but not for me entirely, but for the family. So I could carry on swimming outside. Now, whether the same advice would apply these days, I don't know. But that was the advice in the 60s and 70s. So I wasn't allowed to swim indoors. So I still could carry on swimming, but of course, it was mostly the summer. And then as I got older, I just went back into swimming in pools. Decided it was the right thing to do. And so there's always been a draw for me towards the water.
Yeah.
I was never a particularly sporty kid otherwise. I mean, I like to play a bit of football and at school sports. But for me, the water was always where I could really feel like I could achieve something.
Yeah.
You know, I could swim quite far. I could swim quite quick compared to a lot of people. But also, it was more about just the feeling of being in the water. It was like being liberated.
Mm-hmm.
I remember many times in our pool at home, laying on the bottom of the pool and looking up at the surface, you know, and you have that sort of mercury kind of look about it, and just being completely relaxed. Mm. And then finally bobbing up, you know, and I'm sure my parents were very anxious, but I'd spend a lot more time under it than on top of it.
Yeah. And so then, your relationship with the water then obviously continued, because I know how much you like your surfing. Is there a, you know, can you draw a parallel to the, you know, in terms of the water with surfing and swimming? Are they mutually exclusive?
They're not mutually exclusive. And interestingly, as I've got older, I end up body surfing more than board surfing. So I spend quite a lot of time on a board,
mm-hmm.
and to pretty average success, to be honest. But because I'm now teaching my youngest boy to surf, I'm in the water with him. And so he's on a board and I'm with him with a pair of fins on sometimes, and lining him up, telling him which wave to go for.
Mm.
And then I'll body surf in after him.
Yeah. He's good. So, your son. I think I've taught him a few times. I say taught, I'm a hopeless surfer, but you know, I've pushed him into waves, and he's so enthusiastic. He loves it. And he's obviously taking after his dad in that regard.
He absolutely loves it. And it's great. And with my oldest son, I did the same. And so definitely similarities. I think one of the things for me is stepping off the land.
Yeah.
I always have this feeling that you step off the land, whether you've got a board under your arm or whether you're just going to go for a swim. And there's a feeling that I leave the land and all its associations and troubles and worries behind. Yeah. And I'm in a new medium where different rules apply,
mm.
different priorities, different focus. And it takes the land away.
Yeah.
And you come back to the land at the end, changed for the better, always. Even if you've had a bad surf,
yeah.
I feel still come back better.
There's no such thing as a bad swim. And there's no such thing as a bad moment in the water. So, how did then your line of work come up? And I'm tying this into swimming, especially. Obviously, I know how much you helped me through my rehab. You were completely instrumental and taught me a lot about pain and pain management, and sort of how to get back on the horse to some sort of volume. So how did your work come up first and foremost, and then how has that changed your relationship to the water?
So that's a very good question. And I get asked a lot about how I evolved into doing what I do. And it is very much an evolution. So I had a patchy career when I first left school. I was one of those kids who really didn't really want to be there after about 16. So when I left school, I failed on my A-levels and didn't really want to stay there. Just went off to work. But I ended up working in a local sports center as a lifeguard. Because I could swim, I could use my skills. And then I learned to be a swimming teacher while I was there. So I used to teach kids to swim. And then I traveled with that a bit. And through working in that area, I got more and more interested in human performance, human health. I trained, did some gym instruction training, ended up being a yoga teacher. And from there evolved into osteopathy. So it was a sort of a progressive move towards doing what I do now. In osteopathy, of course, we're well known for treating back pain, and we do that. But I was always interested in going further, and I ended up working, studying with some physiotherapists, very, very influential physiotherapists, who got me more and more interested in pain per se rather than structural back pain. And carrying on being an avid swimmer, it just seemed a natural thing for me to work more and more with people who did what I did and what I was passionate about. So then I think meeting Andy White in Brighton was our mutual friend, Andy yes. White. I think he is instrumental in lots of things. And one was it really reignited in me when the Sea Lanes pop-up was going. And I went down and did a couple of sessions in the tank, and it really reignited me, that the idea that, yeah, this is what I want to do more of, and get involved more in. So that was a sort of more, I guess, recent evolution to really get me to focus on swimming injuries. Shoulders, of course, being the majority of swimming injuries, but by far, for obvious reasons. And shoulders are always tricky, as you well know. So it then really pushed me into studying shoulders a lot deeper. There was an evolution from there, and then also meeting the guys from the Brighton Swimming Club down by the pier. And so, as you probably know, I've seen quite a handful of those as well. So
you have. You are synonymous in Brighton with helping swimmers get back in the water. So, when I came to see you, I had a non swimming injury in turn, but it was obviously affecting my swim. You know, I think I got better quite quickly, but I was still experiencing, you know, a lot of discomfort in the water. You spoke to me very articulately about, and there's no pressure here to repeat that conversation. you spoke to me very articulately about how the body manages pain, and actually pain and inflammation is specifically with regards to shoulder. And obviously there has to be a disclaimer here for anyone listening that if you are experiencing shoulder pain, please go and see a healthcare professional. I remember you saying that quite a lot of the time with shoulder injuries, once you've done a significant portion of rehab, there's an element of just swimming, almost not swimming through it, but going towards the pain, because quite often our body is sending us signals that are sort of hangovers from a potential injury, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay.
I hope I haven't just bastardized your knowledge.
Well, the thing is, talking about this kind of thing is really tricky, and we can tie ourselves in knots and get tongue tied with it, because it is, and you know, even top professionals will always get themselves down a sticky path if they're not careful, because we're talking about a conscious experience, and once we start talking about consciousness, we haven't really got a language that doesn't drift off into metaphor or analogy or a dualistic way of talking. So, but if I remember our conversation correctly, we were talking about what the experience of pain represented. And now we take a couple of steps back, is we look at what pain is for or how it evolved. It's a need state. Or one of the ways of thinking about it is that it's a need state, like hunger or thirst or fatigue. It's an unpleasant experience for most part. It makes you uncomfortable, and it makes you want to take action. And it's the same with the other things what I just mentioned. So fatigue makes us want to rest. And it's a life-sustaining stimulus. Mm-hmm. Hunger makes us want to eat. Otherwise, our blood sugar is going to get too low. Thirst makes us want to drink. Pain makes us want to act, to protect a body part, or to inspect a body part, or to seek help about a body part. And it's a way of keeping us alive. It's a very, very basic human experience, and as far as we know, other animals as well. So in relationship, going back to your shoulder, we can have pain in the absence of any demonstrable damage. One great analogy is you put your hand near a fire, it hurts. You take your hand away. You look at your hand. There's nothing. Nothing's happened. So that was a warning to take action. When you've overloaded a tendon in the shoulder, there may or may not be damage in that tendon. That tendon, you could be having experience that is going to protect you from actually damaging that tendon. So there are messages coming from the tendon, which are we call nociceptive messages. So a nociceptor is a nerve ending that is turned on by damage or potential damage. And that can be mechanical, as in cutting, pulling, that sort of thing, crushing, chemical, radiation damage, or heat. They're the things that hurt. So those nociceptors, they're turned on by those stimuli. And they'll send an electrical current up the nerve. It's just an electrical current. It doesn't have a quality of any kind. There are various junction boxes on the way to the brain where that damage, that signal can be turned up or down. When that message hits your brain with any other associated information that's important, there's a calculation, and then we have to be careful, can drift off into a sort of dualistic way of thinking, but there is an overall body calculation of is this important? Do we need to know about this? So if the tendon is becoming overloaded, in your example, you ended up with the experience of pain. But whether there was any damage in that tendon or not is very hard to say. There was potential damage, most likely. And that's when it starts to hurt. And that's when you become experienced, then you experience pain. Have I answered your question?
You have, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think my kind of basic knowledge prior to coming to see you was this idea that, you know, I may have torn a tendon, and and rehab that I would need to then do would be alongside the tendon itself repairing. However, you quickly took me through some exercises, all of which I could move in the way that you were ascribing, and put my mind at rest. There, no, you haven't torn a tendon. You're just experiencing pain. After a month or two and some you know very good sessions with you, you advised me. You know, you said next time you're in the pool, just acknowledge your pain and continue. And you may find that, you know, it dissipates. You may not, in which case get out and look after yourself, but you may find it dissipates. And that's exactly what happened. And I don't think I would have had the wherewithal or the confidence to do that, you know, had I not sought your help in the first place. But it did seem counterintuitive, you know, to me at that moment of swimming, of thinking, okay, I'm going to give this a go. And it did, it dissipated. And it felt very much against the grain of what perhaps my instinct was telling me to do.
Yes. So yes, that was definitely part of your question that I didn't answer. So so we grow up with an association that pain equals damage. I mean, this is what we learn as a child a lot of the time, and through societal messages, that pain must mean that there's something broken, something torn, something inflamed, something damaged. And for a long time, you know, even within medicine, that was what was thought. With more modern knowledge, we realize now that's not actually the truth. So going back into the pool for you, not only was that tendon still sensitive, and we use this word sensitive rather than damaged or inflamed, but there was a certain expectation from you that this is going to hurt. And because you being a swimmer and how much swimming means to you, that expectation was probably more significant than to someone who only swims occasionally. You know, maybe on holiday, got in the pool or got in the sea, thought, shoulders twingy a bit. I'll be all right. The kids are playing around, and just get on with it. Whereas for you, there was a completely different relationship with the pain and what that pain represented to you. And it's the same for anyone who hurts themselves, any sports person, anyone who needs their body for their job, for instance. If they have pain in relationship to movement, which is important, it's going to have a very different significance. So we have a prediction that this is going to hurt. And in your first stroke, you were right. It did hurt. But with repetition, with controlled stress through that tendon, you downregulated that pain. And you did because you'd done a lot of rehab, but you did also because hopefully from what we worked on is I gave you the confidence to sit with that and give it a good few goes. And then what happens is that you start to produce the endocannabinoids from the brain and endorphins, which are neurotransmitters in response to exercise. And they're very strong painkillers. So then what happens is you start to produce those, the tendon becomes desensitized, you then start to get confidence, and you realize that actually it's safe to move, and those warning signals start to decrease. So fear of spiders, a common fear. How do you get over fear of spiders? Well, you start to talk to someone about them, a therapist or someone who's going to help you through. You may then look at some pictures of spiders. You then may look at a video of spiders. I mean, this is all not in one session, but this is a progressive thing with relaxation techniques and reassurance. You then may enter a room with a spider. You then may approach the cage with a spider, and then eventually, hopefully, you put the spider in your hand. So what happens is that you have an expectation which is associated with fear, damage, threat, and you violate that. This is weird language, but you violate it by exposing yourself to that fear in an environment that's safe. And to a degree, that's what we did with you with the water. We build your confidence away from the water and then said, you know, you get in, you'll pull, but it's going to hurt a little bit. It may or may not. But you're going to be okay. With all the groundwork we did, you had that confidence to go through that.
Yeah, it's that reassurance as well. I'm interested because I remember when we were on this sort of journey together, you mentioned that a similar thing had happened to you and your shoulder.
Yes.
And I mean, what was the experience of that being, obviously being a medical professional yourself, what was that experience like in terms of reassuring yourself that actually everything was going to be okay? Because it's one thing hearing it from, me hearing it from you, which is very reassuring and comforting, obviously me not being any sort of medical professional. But was there any difference in terms of you having to do that to yourself?
Well, that's always very, very humbling to have an injury as a healthcare professional. So I, coming out of lockdown, I hadn't been in the water of any kind for ages. And there was some, as you know, that the surf in Brighton is not great, but if it's on, you get in. And it was the first time I was able to go down to the hot pipe and paddle out. And the surf was rubbish. I mean, it was the first time I could get in the water, and it was spring and there was light and I could get in. So I went down and I stayed in way too long and paddling way too hard for really average waves. But, I was not going to miss my opportunity. And I have history of a rotator cuff tear in my left shoulder anyway. And that was something I'd done over 20 years ago, and I'd managed it, and it had been okay. I woke up the next day after this swim, and I couldn't move my shoulder. I could hardly elevate it at all. I suddenly thought, "What have I done?" So I gave myself a good talking to, and started to rest it and do some rehab, and it kind of got better, but I got stuck. So one of the privileges of being in my position is, of course, I've met some amazing people, amazing therapists over the years. And there was a woman who really taught me a lot about shoulders. And I contacted her and said, "Look, can you help? I'm stuck." And so she took me through probably what I would take anyone else through. But because she knows everything about shoulders, well, she knows a hell of a lot about shoulders. I had the reassurance to do what I told you to do. So I did the rehab, and then I got in the pool first, and my first stroke really hurt. And I just thought to myself, I can't believe it. I've done the rehab. I've just been really careful. Nothing's helped. But I thought, well, I'm going to finish this length anyway. And as I just relaxed into it, really started to fade really quite quickly. I think I probably did sets of 250 at the time, just 10 lengths and then rest. But I managed to get through a kilometer, in sections, and it just built from there. And it really was that first pull was very humbling, but a great lesson that this is okay. You know, it's going to be all right, you know.
Yeah. It's funny how, like, in terms of our own psyche, how we need objective help, even for things that we know enough about. I'm referring to you know, me advising others on their swim training, which, you know, I enjoy doing and I like doing. But then when it comes to looking at my own training and my own progress, and I start to beat myself up about, you know, a week where I'm not swimming as well as I perhaps was the week before, it's very difficult to be objective about your own progress. Whereas I know if I took a step back and looked at someone else on the same journey that I may have been on, I would, you know, be very quick to say, come on, you're being really hard on yourself. Do you relate to that? Does that resonate?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We need some external validation. We need support. I think when it comes to health and pain, and that's something we learn very young, you know, if a child falls over, what's the first thing it does? Looks for a parent. Looks for the parent before it cries, usually. It looks for the parent, then it cries. Or if the parent's not available, it will cry to attract the parent's attention. And what do? You go to the child and you say, where does it hurt? And then the child shows you and you put your hand on it. I mean, this is very basic stuff. You know, we need that reassurance that it's okay. And then you tell your child it's okay. And usually if it's okay, they're going to stop crying pretty quick and get up and carry on running.
I'm going to remember that halfway through, you know, a channel swim. Actually, I'm going to remember that in a few weeks' time on a swim trek trip on my 6-hour swim. I'm just going to remember it's okay. Mark says it's okay. So everything's going to be okay. So just going back to the six questions, what are your earliest memories of swimming in the open water? Is it that time in Mallorca, or is there an earlier memory that you can think of?
I'd say that my earliest ones is definitely in Mallorca, but I have another memory which luckily has been captured on cinefilm. I've been going through all my dad's stuff, and he had some cinefilm transposed onto video, and then I've had it digitized, and it's my first experience of being in Cornwall, and I think I'm 9. I think it was 1973. There you go. Gives you my age away. And I'm on the beach. No wetsuit, of course. You know, just a pair of trunks and a wooden belly board. And I pick the belly board up and I run into the sea. And he's cinning me with catching my first wave. And I've still got it on my computer. So, which is very poignant because my dad just passed away a month ago, and so I can kind of picture him standing there with the cine watching me do it with the same pride that I look at when I see Leo swim, Leo surf, and also Louis. So I think that I can remember being in Menorca, but of course the memory of being Cornwall I can just replay. So that's deeply embedded in me, because, you know, I've been in love with Cornwall ever since.
What a lovely treasured memory, and I'm sorry. I'm so sorry to hear about your dear dad.
But it's play, isn't it?
It's play,
and that's what we want to have memories of.
Yeah,
that's what we like to record, those memories of play.
Yeah, and I think that's what the water represents for you know, the vast majority of people is a sense of play. You don't have to go down to the fountains in Brighton in the middle of the summer, you know, to see the joy on all the kids' faces, you know, playing around in the water, splashing. So let me ask you, what does open water swimming mean to you now, as someone who sort of swims in the sea, surfs in the sea, facilitates the sea, and how has it changed through knowing what you know now about swimmers and their shoulders? How has your relationship to the water changed?
It has. It's evolved over time. So right from the early stages of just pure mucking about in the water, you know, as a kid, to then being a bit more serious, I suppose, about it, you know, surfing. And so I came to surfing a bit late. I'd always been in the water, and I loved being in the sea and loved being in waves. I spent about a year and a half in Australia back in my 20s. And I did actually a lot of, I didn't surf there, which is the most bizarre thing, but I think I did once, but I body surfed a lot. So I met a guy out there, became friends, and he took me body surfing up at Whale Beach, in north of Sydney. which was I have amazing memories of. And then I moved down to Brighton in 1999 and decided I was going to learn to surf, not because I was in Brighton, but it was an evolution of all the water stuff. I'd lived in London before then, so most of my swimming was in the pools in London. And so went down and hooked up with my old school friend down in Cornwall, who lives down there, and we got into surfing. So we were I did spend about 20 years pursuing that to like I said, to a very mediocre level. But I was quite driven and to train and surf as much as I could. Mm. Now it's evolving out of being so serious about it and going almost back to just the sheer enjoyment of being in the sea, feeling the movement, the fact it's different every single time. Sometimes I'll push it a bit to really see how far I can go, how fast I can go. Sometimes I'm just going to be there in the water, just the pure enjoyment of being in there. And then with the kids, obviously, with Leo. So it has really changed. And I think it's different every time you go in, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
With open water, partly because of the conditions, and partly because of mental state as well. So sometimes I'll have more time to go. Sometimes my clinic is just off the seafront, which I'm very lucky to have, and I've got a bit of an extended lunch break, and I can dash down and just crack out 20 minutes, half an hour, and get back and see my patients in the afternoon. So yes, it's an evolution, and I'm expecting it to carry on changing.
Yes. So I asked you that question as a which is obviously one of my standard questions, but it was a lead for me really to ask you, do you get scared that your shoulder is going to start hurting again?
I don't. In the water, I don't. In fact, the more I swim, the better it is. So if I have time away from the pool, and if I've recently, because of everything that's been going, I've neglected swimming and neglected exercising because I've had too much to do. And my shoulder's a bit twingy. But after we talk today, I'm going to go to the pool. So I know now that that's what I need to do. So it's moved from that being a threatening thing to this is what's going to look after my shoulder. So I don't worry about my shoulder in the sea at all. And that's nice.
That's very that's reassuring, because
yes,
it's slowly dissolved the worry about my shoulder.
Yes.
So do you believe then in inflammation? Because we had a long chat about inflammation and what people think it means and what actually it really means.
Well, inflammation is a distinct recognized process. It's an partly immune process. So if you damage a tissue, mechanically damage it, for instance. So if you twist your ankle and you tear a ligament, the substances released from the tissues act on the local blood vessels and they make them leaky. And they attract fluid, leaks out of the blood vessels into the area, which is an immune reaction. So you get heat. Yeah. So that's because there's more blood coming into the area. So anywhere there's an increased heat in the body, that's because this blood's been shunted there. You get immune cells coming out. They're going to help mop up the dead stuff and start the healing process. So that's a thing, inflammation. Now, sore tendons, which is what we assumed, what we worked out, what was going on with your shoulder. Sore tendons thicken when they're under threat. So the tendon itself will start to absorb liquid. The thinking is that is to protect the tendon, because a stiffer tendon is safer. So what happens is the tendon absorbs fluid to protect itself. The trouble is, of course, that can become a problem in its own right. So especially if that tendon is in a space where there's not a lot of room, that makes that nodule of room even less room. So that can become an issue. Also, the tendon behaves differently because it's now not as springy, it's not as flexible. So and it's an ongoing debate. So we're talking about shoulder, rotator cuff tendon, bicep tendon. there is ongoing debate about whether how much inflammation there actually is in the process. Whether the pain you're feeling is related to inflammation or not is still an open question. But when studies have been done on painful tendons, there's not a big inflammatory process going on. There's a caveat to all of that, of course, is if you've torn the tendon, so if you have a traumatic injury, you fall, you twist, and there's actual signs of an acute tear, you know there's going to be inflammation involved. That's how your body's going to help heal it. But if you've overloaded the tendon, either chronically or acutely, there might be some thickening, but we can't say for sure whether there's an inflammatory process going on there.
Mm.
So it is, once again, we assume things are inflamed when they hurt. And you can see an Achilles. You can't see a rotator cuff tendon unless you use ultrasound, but you can see an Achilles. And often, you know, the painful one is bigger and palpably bigger and visibly bigger than the other one.
Mm.
But whether that's inflammation or not is an open question. And if it's hot and red, the chances are it is, but often they're not hot and they're not red. Mm. But you squeeze it and it hurts and it's big.
Mm.
That quite possibly is thickening from fluid.
It's so interesting. And we talked at length about this, and it completely fascinates me. And I think it will hopefully interest a lot of people listening to this who are also swimmers. You mentioned that if we looked at any swimmer's shoulders under an MRI or an ultrasound, we would see all sorts of things going on that you wouldn't necessarily see in a diagram of how the shoulder should operate.
Yeah, so that's that goes for almost any internal structure in the body, with MRI scans of the spine and all sorts of, you know, joints and tendons. So in overhead athletes, which swimmers are, you're going to find rotator cuff tears. And I don't mean torn in half, but I mean tears within the tendon. And in fact, in anybody, by the time they're in their 70s, if you do an ultrasound and MRI on their rotator cuff tendons, if you don't find any tears, they're a freak. You know, we're designed to wear out on the inside as much as we are on the outside. You know, we have gray hair. Well, I have lots of it. we have wrinkles. We have signs of aging. And why should that be confined to what's on the outside?
Yeah.
It's all connective tissue. This is all collagen-related connective tissue. So inside wears out as well. You know, we're finite. We're built to last for a certain amount of time. You know, if we were made of stuff that didn't wear out, we'd be too heavy to move.
Mm.
So, you know, there's always any structure-function relationship, there's a compromise. So back to your original question. So absolutely, overhead athletes, you're going to find tears in the cuff, but they don't always hurt.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing. We're so used to, with the advent of X-ray and then of MRI, we were able to look inside. And when things didn't look like we expected them to look, and there happened to be some pain in that area, we just wrongly associated those two things together.
Yeah.
So you can MRI shoulders with people, swimmer's shoulders with a rotator cuff tear, and the left shoulder hurts, the right doesn't. And you MRI the other shoulder and it's got the same tears. But the left shoulder hurts and the right one doesn't.
And why is that?
Because it's not as simple as what you see is what you get. There's something about the way that shoulder is functioning, the painful one, that is causing irritation. So you can't say for sure that tear is even involved in that irritation. It may or may not be. It's the same with a MRI of lumbar spines. You see disc bulges, and huge amounts of people have disc bulges and have no pain.
Yeah. I think I came to you and I was terrified that, you know, the worst case scenario, me being catastrophizing as always, that, you know, surgery might have to happen. And I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong, but you said something along the lines of, you said very rarely does shoulder surgery for swimmers end up being successful.
Depends on the age group and depends on what you want. So shoulder surgery for shoulder injuries in younger athletes can be the right thing to do. And there's caveats to all of the things we're talking about, of course. Sometimes it is the right thing to do. But really, for the vast majority of people, once you get past about 21, 22, shoulder surgery becomes less and less successful. And you can do just as well with rehab. Mm. Once again, there are caveats. You know, if you are professional and your life depends on it, your career depends on it. And for instance, in things like rugby, you're going to have people having shoulder surgery quite a lot. But for recreational athletes, unless there's a really clear demonstrable reason in that shoulder, there's a what's called a surgical target, you're really not going to do very well, any better than rehab. Mm. Once again, you know, there's no black and white about this, but yeah. The research shows that rehab is going to probably be just as good as anything else. And then, you don't take any of the risks of surgery, which are anesthetic, infection, complications, nerve damage, et cetera, which I'm not saying all surgeries are going to give you that, but there is a risk, you know, as soon as you have surgery. The other thing with surgery, often it means removing something. Now, if that thing is clearly causing an issue, so you've got a big bony growth coming down off the bottom of the cremaclavicular joint, a really big one, and it's damaging the tendon, then of course. But once you've cut, you've altered something. You've altered a structure. If you take something away, you've altered it. Mm. And that might, in the short term, might be okay. In the long term, might not be so okay.
Yeah. I guess, like you say, with all these things, it's a balance between what you're hoping to achieve and what you're willing to sort of sacrifice in both the short and long term.
Exactly. It depends very much on what your values are. What do you really want? And that's when we have those discussions, and I probably had it with you, and about, you know, your training and your shoulder pain at the time, and it also goes with surgery and any other intervention, is you start with the end point. What do you want at the end? And then you reverse engineer the process back, looking at what your options are, rather than saying, I've got shoulder pain, surgery is recommended. Well, I've got shoulder pain, but what does that mean? And how's it going to stop me getting for my goal? And what am I willing to compromise on the way to the goal?
Yeah.
And that's the important discussion to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. Wow. So someone once said to me, always remember that the water wants you. In terms of rehab, the water has always, for years, has always been a really valuable place for people to feel supported and for people to, people to use, whether it be runners with you know, lower impact. But for swimmers, the water is both the kind of cure and also the mountain. Is that sort of something that you recognize?
Yes. I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, I've listened to this question being answered in so many different ways on your podcast, and you've posed it in a very interesting way that I didn't expect. But you're right. It is the water for swimmers is that it just draws you to it all the time. Like you said, you know, I think some of your other guests have said you see a body of water and you wonder what it's like to swim in it. Mm. You know, you don't see a body of water, that's a nice reflection, or there's some nice ducks. It's like, I wonder what it's going to be like to swim across there, you know. So yes, you're drawn to it, but if you are a swimmer like yourself and some of your other guests, of course, it's a massive challenge. I have stopped having that relationship with the water, which is quite interesting. I've stopped timing myself.
Nice.
I've stopped giving myself challenges. I'm now using it as a almost like a mindfulness practice. I get in, and all I pursue now, so I still have a goal, is I pursue the idea of a flow state. I'm looking for flow. I'm looking for that feeling where you just move and you start to lose sense of effort, and you lose sense of time and to a degree lose sense of place. Of course, in the open water, you've always got to be careful of that. But and there's a paradox there, because flow state comes when you're not trying too hard to look for it. It's like meditation. The harder you try and meditate, of course, the further away you're going to get from the goal. But that for me is my goal. So I can relate to it historically, and I can obviously listen to your guests and listen to you. I can see how much that is there's the paradox between the tension between the two poles of this is, I just need to be here. I want to be here, but I've set myself this huge mountainous challenge. And whether it's to do with what I do, whether my age, I don't know, but I'm in a phase now where I don't have those self challenges anymore. It's just about being in the water.
Yeah.
And trying to get just to get the groove on. And that's it.
That's a lovely answer. So where would your ideal swim be then, with that in mind? Where would you be able to get into the most comfortable flow state?
Well, that's two questions, because I've got two answers to that.
Yeah, that's fine.
So the flow state one is interesting. So I have had amazing flow state experiences just in a pool, because it is the absolute monotony and the rhythm that you can get into in a pool, as long as it's not busy, you've got a lane. And it's like a trance. You just go. And people have watched me swim, and some have talked to lifeguards, and they say, you take exactly the same number of strokes for every length. That's not intentional. That's just, you get in that rhythm and you find your rhythm, your breathing settles down, you have no pain, and you're just going. So I have had those experiences in you know, not in the open water, but in the open water, where I always love to swim, is in Cornwall. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I hate cold. As I've got older, I really don't like cold. So I should answer your question, the holodeck question, by saying, oh, it's going to be somewhere in the Caribbean with crystal clear water. But, and I'm sure that would be a really pleasant experience, but it's about the relationship for me of being in Cornwall. You know, I go once a year with my family, we rent a beach house, and we're 2 weeks, and I'm up at dawn with my youngest son, who's now not so young, but he's always loved rabbits. And so we go at dawn, we go across the sand dunes looking for rabbits, because they're where we stay, there's wild rabbits everywhere, and we have a count. And we have this ritual, and we still do it, even though he's getting too old for it, really. But we still do it. And so what happens is we do that. And then we go down and look at the sea as the sun's coming up. And then he goes back and has breakfast, and I go for a swim. And the sun comes up sometimes as I'm in the water. And it comes up over the back of the beach because of the aspect of where the beach is. It's west facing. So you can swim along, and one eye looks out towards the horizon, the other eye looks out towards the golden sunrise coming straight across the water, and you've got it glancing across the top of the water. So that's a really special time.
That's glorious. Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. What a beautiful picture you've painted. Gosh, so that leads me on beautifully to my last question. What a lovely answer. Where was your last swim, and how was it?
So once again, I'm going to steal two answers to that question. My last physical swim was at the local pool. And it was good. It was good. Yeah. I could push it a little bit and could get into a bit of a groove with some fast laps and some slow laps as well. So my last open water swim was at Puttsborough at the end of October. So I went down for a family holiday to Somerset. We got some friends who lived down there, and we drove over to Puttsborough for a dawn session. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful morning. There was sets of about two to three foot coming in, 3 foot at the biggest. There was about eight people in the water. And I went out with my son, took him out. So I just had my fins on, and he was on his board. And we just had a most beautiful session. And Heaven. So it was a combination of him surfing and then me body surfing. And then they left me to it for a while. He got in, went and had a hot chocolate. So then I had my play in, and it was glorious. It was crystal clear, because as you know, the headland at Puttsborough protects the wind. So there was a westerly, but in that little bay there, it was like glass with just these 2-3 foot lumps coming through. It was absolutely glorious.
Absolute heaven. I love Puttsborough. Gosh. Mark, thank you so much. It goes without saying, if anyone is in the Brighton area and they have any sort of shoulder, back, or any sort of injury at all, and they are a swimmer, Mark is your guy. Kemp Osteo, very easy to find on Google.
Well, thanks, Will. Thanks for your kind words. I'm humbled, and it's been a real pleasure and a real honour to be here.
Thank you, Mark. I can safely say that I always have you slightly in my head when I take my first few strokes in the pool. Thank you for all your help in my recovery, and thank you for coming onto the podcast to share your knowledge with everyone. I'll be back next week with another episode.
So until then, happy swimming.